Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Denny Rancourt. Denny has been on many times before. He's very special to me because of what he represents, what he believes, what he stands for, and he gave up a lot to stick by those fundamental beliefs. They're certainly ones that I agree with, and I hope I can use Denny and others like him as a role model for myself. Denny, welcome back.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Steve. I'm happy to give you an update on my various, I guess you could call them battles.
Indeed.
Trying
so
to find justice.
I think of you as another chapter in the book of Job, Denny.
Oh, my. it feels that way sometimes. The most recent thing that has happened to me is that I went through 4 years of legal battles in order to do a legal process in order to recover my job, because the University of Ottawa dismissed me, even though I was a full and tenured professor of physics for 23 years. I was a professor there, and they dismissed me. Many of your listeners know about that, but the legal battle to even just be heard on the dismissal case lasted from 2009 to 2013, and now the hearings into that binding labor arbitration are finally finished. They ended, the last hearing date was June 26, 2013, so it's very recent. And within some months, we should have a final, judge's ruling on whether or not the dismissal was justified. So it's been quite a battle, and the hearings were quite hectic and intense. I was cross-examined for days and days and days on every possible aspect of my activities in society, whether it be blogging or writing articles or being interviewed on the radio. They had entire transcripts of the radio interviews that I did with various radio stations in Canada and the U.S. They had all the recordings of everything I'd ever said on or off campus. When I would go to give a talk at another university, they would send a spy would collect the recordings of those talks and make transcripts of them, what they call transcripts, or make notes about them, and give them to the administration. And so they did this for years. They were surveilling me without my consent, without my knowledge. And we finally, had a full arbitration where all of these things, a lot of these things were disclosed. Of course, many things were not disclosed, but a lot were disclosed. And so that was the last thing that I've just been through, and now I anxiously await the ruling on that case. The hearings were quite eventful. There were many members of the public present in these public hearings, and the media was very present as well, especially in the closing arguments phase of the hearings. It's quite remarkable what the university was arguing. I'm going to give my memory and my opinion about how the hearings went. This, in no way am I trying to influence the outcome of the judgment or anything like that. I'm just giving my own opinion and sort of impressions of how it went. But the university basically had two major arguments. They spent most of their time not arguing that they were right to dismiss me, but instead arguing that even if they were wrong to dismiss me, I should not be allowed back on campus. So most of their energy, most of their resources were spent on that argument. So so the legal point was like this, you know, well, maybe we weren't right to dismiss him. Maybe that wasn't quite right after all. You know, he's a tenured professor, and maybe he didn't do anything that deserved dismissal. But even if you find that, I'm sort of paraphrasing the university's position, but even if you were to find, and we don't think you will, that we weren't right to dismiss the man, please don't let him back on campus, and these are the reasons. And they gave two lines of arguments. One was they actually seriously argued, and there were several days of this, and we went through it in cross-examination at great length. They actually argued that I was inciting students to violence, that this was a serious argument that they were putting forward. I mean, they put it forward as a serious argument. And, the kinds of evidence that they had, for example, at one point, well, they argued that I was an anarchist, for example. And I explained that anarchism, you know, there's a street meaning of anarchism, but it's also a field of academic study, and that I'd given talks about anarchism and its impact on education and so on at academic conferences where I was an invited speaker, and I listed, the talks I'd given at various universities and at various conferences about anarchism. And I explained that, you know, it was a political theory, and that there were many prominent intellectuals who had publicly said that they saw this political theory as being one of the best theories to create an ideal society. For example, Noam Chomsky is of that opinion. But they were trying to tar me by calling me an anarchist in the hope that the arbitrator would adopt the kind of street meaning of anarchism, as opposed to see it for what it is, and see it for how I study it and apply it, you see. And so I had the occasion to explain that to the arbitrator during cross-examination, and I did. But as part of these arguments, for example, at one point they showed a music video from YouTube that is a music video about anarchism, with a lot, and the person who had made the video, I had nothing to do with it, but the person who had made the video had all these images of, you know, young, you know, people dressed in black at demonstrations and street fires and broken windows and all this kind of thing were part of the imagery in this music video, and they insisted on showing this in evidence and having the arbitrator watch this video. And so they were trying to, define anarchism as being this violent source of chaos, and at the same time associate me with anarchism. This was one of their lines of argument to try to prove that I was inciting students to violence. And they went into all of my emails, and they found that I had been for many years discussing with student activists about how to be effective in their activism when they were demanding things from the university administration. And I was, you know, having exchanges with them about what were effective tactics and what you could do and what you couldn't do and what I felt would be going further and pushing your point in a more, a stronger stance approach and so on. And they used these communications that I was having with students as evidence of what they called inciting violence. Fortunately for me, the media was present in the room, and the media generally did not take these arguments very seriously. That was my impression of it. If you look at the media articles, the media were stunned by these arguments. So that, I think, this is just my opinion, but I think that the media response to their arguments put a damper on things for them, and they kind of cooled it. I noticed during the cross-examination phase. But that was one serious line of questioning. And
if I could add one thing,
yeah,
I've written many articles on Lynn Stewart, who is a personal friend, and she went through a greater ordeal than you because she's serving a 10-year prison sentence unjustly.
Yeah.
I mean, a horrendous situation, and she's suffering from stage 4 cancer. She's literally dying, and even though granted by the prison warden compassionate release, the Bureau of Prisons turned her down flat, and they lied, and they said she's getting better when she's getting worse. But I remember when I began writing about her, I think it was in the very first article a good number of years ago, and I related the picture that was painted by prosecutors in court. They literally took this glorious human being and they transformed her for the jury and for the press and anyone else who paid attention to what they were saying into this monster. This monster.
Oh, yeah.
And they use secret material and secret evidence, and they plastered information around neighborhoods where she lived on posters. And they enlisted the help of people in the community in which she lived to get on this bandwagon of hate to demonize her. In other words, to take practically a living saint and, as I said, turn her into a monster. It was a huge lie, a huge injustice. It got her a short prison term, transformed by an appeals court demanding the district judge should be harsher, from 16 months to 10 years, and she'll never live out the 10 years. Where she's in prison, her husband Ralph Pointer says she's not in prison, she's in a death camp. And that's exactly where she is. That's another example of how they can take a real decent human being, and they literally, with a litany of lies, transform that person into any kind of a creature they want to.
Yes, well, that's something I've learned from the legal system, and I think the legal systems must be the same everywhere in every society in this respect. One thing I've learned is that they pretend, they have this mythology that they're giving you a fair hearing, but actually the most important psychological pressure and influence in the court is creating bias and prejudice against the person. In other words, it's all about impressions, it's all about associations and tarring and this kind of thing. And so a lot of energy goes into that direction. They're trying to paint this picture that this person, you know, they're trying to create the moral high ground for themselves and the moral low ground for the person that they're going after. And they do that by trying to create an impression. And they do it constantly. It's like a main preoccupation. So there's a real contrast between this mythology that you're innocent until proven guilty, that only evidence that's brought in properly through the evidence process is allowed. There's a real contrast between that mythology and the real fact that the lawyers actually, in making arguments, irrespective of the evidence, can say whatever the heck they want to you know, a large degree. And it's allowed, and it's clear from how it functions that it's about creating an impression in the judge's or the jury's mind that this person is not worthy of being treated as though you need to presume innocence and only look at the hard facts and the evidence that's allowed in order to decide otherwise. You know, that's like, it's completely counter to that mythology, what actually happens in court. And that is, I think, one of the biggest shockers when you're involved with the legal system. The extent to which the stories that they tell you about how the system is or should be is a complete lie. You know, it's a complete lie. It's all about deciding whether this person is worthy of their freedom and of their livelihood and so on, or not, through impressions. That in terms of the practice of it, there's a large element of that, and that's very disturbing, and that's what it's all about. So it's such a lie to pretend otherwise, because if what I'm saying is not true, then why do they put so much energy in doing exactly that? You see? see what I mean?
I see exactly what you mean, Denny. And,
yeah.
And your situation matters to me, not just because of you as an individual and the gross injustice done. You really a gross injustice. Instead of the honors that you deserved, they literally transformed you into something entirely different than what you are. But one of my key issues that I write about constantly, and I just wrote another article. I wrote about a young man I wrote about some years ago, and I wrote a second article updating his status. Political prisoners in America, the same thing happens in Canada. I've written about several in Canada, but I've written about many in Israel, and I've written about many in America, literally dozens, I would say five, six or more dozens over the years. I'd love to do a book on this if I can get my editor, publisher interested in publishing one. They're concerned about spending money on something that will at least break even, hopefully make a few dollars. But it's a marvelous topic to expose the hypocrisy of a nation like America, because America is so important that they literally honor their worst and they persecute their best. And I've got dozens of examples of glorious human beings, some well-known, some not so well-known, but they were on the right side of things. They champion what's right, they oppose what's wrong, and they paid for it with rigged trials, with prosecutions, with convictions, with prison terms, some shorter ones, some longer ones. And along with Lynn, another terrible, terrible case, I'll mention it briefly, the largest Muslim charity in America, the Bush administration went after them. I think they went after about six people. Two were out of the country, and they couldn't get their dirty hands on them, but they got four, and they put them on trial. The two main principals got 65 years in prison for, in their words, giving toys, not tanks, giving books, not bombs, and that's exactly what they did. And they gave charity in America. And the other two men, I think one got 20 years and another got 15 years. Again, they should have built statues to these people. They appealed up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court turned them down flat, wouldn't even hear their case.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there'd be a lot to say about what the Supreme Court chooses to hear and not hear. That's quite remarkable as well. It's almost like there's a rule that the Supreme Court, at least in Canada, and I'm sure it must be the same in the States, but the case that they'll take on has to be a toy case. And what I mean by that is, it has to be pretty much irrelevant in terms of the big picture. It's got to be, in principle, you know, again, according to this mythology, important. But in actual practice, it's one person that has supposedly, let's say, said something on the internet that is dreadful, you know, hate speech. And so let's spend all these resources demonstrating that in Canada, hate speech of this type is not allowed, because that will somehow purify the web in Canada and will make society better. So let's spend all these resources at the Supreme Court level arguing these, what I would call, crazy cases where you've got some poor, misguided person who, because of their background and their childhood and whatever, has decided that the interpretation of the Bible is such that he should go around putting flyers in people's mailboxes to critique the existence of being gay and choosing to be gay or choosing to have the gay lifestyle versus and being gay and so on, and attacking that from their perspective, their very personal perspective. Okay, so let's spend a gazillion dollars trying to sort out if a society can rightfully do that or not, and so on. I mean, it doesn't matter in the sense that if there are crimes against people, if people are targeted for who they are and what they believe and their lifestyles and so on, then those crimes are what need to be dealt with by effective police work and a fair justice system. But you don't spend all these resources trying to sort out the ideology and the legal logic of whether or not you should prevent some poor person from saying whatever the heck they want, you know. And of course, when you speech is just speech, but if you're targeting someone and you're personally attacking them in a way to hurt them by, you know, you're right there face to face and you're not letting them speak and you're screaming at them and you're intimidating them. And then so, well, that's a crime. That's harassment, intimidation, and so on. You can deal with that. But what I see is the Supreme Court going in the direction of these thought crimes instead of perfecting how you deal with true crimes against persons. There's just so much absurd stuff going on in terms of how resources are used. I'm personally of the opinion that I'm all for free expression, and I see, in fact, my book is largely about this, but I see the importance of differences in opinion and differences of expression and style of expression and choice of words being the best way to deal with that is through more expression, more debate, more discussion, more argument, and it should all be free, and that in the end, it's through these interactions that you sort things out as a society and individual to individual. You stop the crimes, the actual crimes, but you free the expression that allows you to talk about these crimes and whether or not they're crimes and to what extent they're crimes and how much harm they do and so on. You have a free, completely free forum to discuss while being vigilant about actual crimes of physical harm and true intimidation. And you know, what I find with a lot of these crimes is that the court system does not acknowledge that different people in society have different power. They look at the crime in terms of determining the crime itself as though it were detached from the players that are involved in this criminal situation and their power. I mean, if some poor schmuck photocopies flyers and hands them out because he has a strong religious or political opinion, that cannot compare to some wealthy person who controls a newspaper or a TV show or a news broadcasting system putting out the same kind of material to try and influence society and to create an environment in our environment where certain lifestyles and beliefs and so on are denigrated. The two situations are just not comparable. They're just completely different. You've got one misguided individual with no influence, no power on one side, which is what, you know, the Supreme Court will jump on and want to take care of that case and analyze it and spend incredible resources arguing it out and developing the law around it. Whereas when you've got these powerful players, like it could be a politician calling for war, how is that not hate speech? You know, that you can't touch. You can't touch it.
And, of course, these people with these vicious ideas, Denny, they have the power of the major media behind them to literally regurgitate everything they say, not once, but repeatedly, especially on television.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Canada is really big on hate speech, and I don't think it's as important phenomenon in the United States because freedom of expression is much more guarded in the U.S. But if we're going to start talking about hate speech and we're going to start regulating hate speech, well, then let's look at what powerful corporate masters and powerful politicians, let's look at what they say in terms of drawing us into the biggest crime of all, which is war, or in terms of drawing us into policies which are essentially genocidal. I mean, genocide is something we participate in as modern societies, let's face it, and that we continue to participate in. How is justifying genocide and justifying war, how is that not hate speech? I mean, to me, that's the highest, if you're in a position of power, that's the highest form of hate speech. You actually have the influence to bring people to war, this all-out destruction, the greatest crime of all that includes all crimes. I mean, you know, how can we talk about hate speech and not touch that and consider that those kinds of statements by politicians and military people and others and analysts and so on that have influence are privileged somehow? That's just privileged, you know? Like, you can't touch that. You can't look at it. To me, that's insane. And so to me, that brings disrespect, disrespect to the courts themselves. The fact that they will only, if you look statistically at the cases they take on these stupid little cases that involve misguided individuals, and they go wild with those, and they will never touch when someone sues a powerful person. In fact, they have mechanisms to throw out those cases. One of the mechanisms that's being used in Ontario here, which is quite common, is the person, the powerful person or body or corporation being attacked for whatever tortuous behavior that they had against an individual, will do a motion to strike the action. Well, a motion to strike is like saying, we don't think this person should have their day in court to try and prove that we did them harm. Well, those darn motions to strike succeed statistically when it's a powerful person that is doing the motion to strike. So we had an example like that where the Prime Minister was being sued by a former member of Parliament who was, you know, dethroned and taken out of office and so on by the powerful Prime Minister's office. And they simply did a motion to strike, and it was largely successful. It was virtually entirely successful. This happens all the time. I know of students that sued a university here in Ottawa, Carleton University, and it was a clear case where there was really serious abuse, I thought, in my opinion. Well, they did a motion to strike, and they basically struck the great majority of the items that were in the statement of claim, and so on. So there's the perfect tool. You go after a powerful person, the law should apply equal to them, whether it's a corporate person or whoever, and they pull out this motion to strike business, and you don't get your day in court. You don't get to see the evidence. You don't get to go to discovery. It's just stopped dead in its track right away.
Well, that's exactly right, Denny. Huh? I mean, that literally is exactly right. To me, the classic example in the time frame that I can reflect on best is the grand Wall Street theft over the past decade or two, where literally not one major Wall Street figure has ever gone to trial for anything. I don't think any gone to trial for virtually anything at all, but certainly not for a criminal offense, even though they stole literally multi-billions of dollars their business model literally is grand theft, and they keep stealing on a daily basis, and nobody lays a glove on any of the people most responsible. That shows the way justice works, and I guess it's the same in Canada.
Yeah. Legal theft is allowed. And if it's illegal, well, it's white-collar crime, so it's not too serious, right?
Exactly.
That's the thinking.
The old Jean Valjean syndrome, steal a loaf of bread and go to prison, steal a prison, and they open the gates and say, well, steal another one. Steal anything you want. If you're rich and powerful enough, you literally can do anything you want. There are two sets of rules, like companies that keep two sets of books. I mean, there's one set of rules for ordinary people, and there's another set of rules for the ruling class. And those set of rules amounts to do anything you want, and we won't lay a glove on you. That's the way the system works.
Yeah.
Denny, let's take a quick break.
Sure.
Hold your thought, and we'll come right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back. On with Denny Raincourt. Denny, a couple of other important examples of U.S. Canadian slash Western style justice. The case of Bradley Manning, a 2013 Nobel Peace Prize nominee. Of course, he'll never win. And of course, Edward Snowden, a 2014 Nobel Peace Prize nominee. Manning already has been consigned to a long prison term. His trial is wrapping up, but we know the outcome. It's just a matter of how long a prison term they're going to give him. The judge will make the sole decision. That was the defense's choice rather than a jury. But a jury would have been certainly not one of his peers. It would have been hanging military officers that would have crucified him. So instead of a bunch of hanging military officers, he will risk his neck with one of them, an army colonel or lieutenant, either colonel or a lieutenant colonel, a woman. Maybe they thought a woman would show more compassion than a man. Not a chance. Obama pronounced him guilty. There is no civil or military judge that would literally countermand the president and the commander-in-chief. So Manning, you can already call him guilty. It just, I mean, what will he get, 10 years, 20 years life in prison? And Edward Snowden, who's seeking asylum in Russia, and members of the Senate Intelligence Committee. I think the House Intelligence Committee is on this as well. They threatened Russia. They threatened Russia with sanctions if Russia doesn't hand over Snowden. Well, there's no extradition treaty between the two countries. America doesn't extradite the people that Russia wants. Oh, maybe some low-level thugs and criminals they're important to hold accountable, but they certainly don't rise to the level of extreme wrongdoing at the federal level in a country. So Snowden did a marvelous service. I've written about what he talked about years ago, not in the depth that he explained it, but his importance is that he connected the dots for millions of people who knew practically nothing or nothing at all. So people all over the world know something about this now, and they know about him. And here's a guy who certainly deserves protection. I don't think Russia's going to extradite him. I'd be shocked if they ever did it. But the pressure is being put on. John Kerry warned Venezuela's president, Maduro, if you do anything to help Snowden, we're going to come down on you like a hammer. Well, you can't quite talk to Russia that way, but sanctions against Russia, what do they want to do? Disrupt a bilateral relationship that has some importance. Both countries can help each other to the advantage of each country separately and mutually, but this is the kind of badgering and pillaring that goes on. So you've got that thing going on. You've got the persecution of two glorious human beings who literally stuck their necks out, and risked all, and this is the result for them. One is safe, although he'll always be looking over his shoulder, and the other one doesn't have a chance, and this is what's called justice in America, Denny.
Yeah. Well, you know, these cases of high-level whistleblowing are very encouraging. It's very exciting that we live in a world where there are responsible professionals who are willing to risk it all and in order to disclose things that are this important, to disclose massive crimes, whether they be about civil liberties or war crimes and so on. The fact that this is even happening suggests to me that there is the beginning of a change in society, that there are nuclei of people who are becoming conscious and who want to do the right thing and who feel compelled to do the right thing and to break out of this very constrained life that the system imposes on all professionals, all managers, all employees are just like in straitjackets. You owe them everything. You can't even say things on the weekend that won't get you fired if your employer doesn't like it, and they're allowed to do that. So it's very, very constraining to live that way, and some people are that. I think the level of pressure and control on people's lives has increased to the point where now more and more high-level professionals are trying to break free of this, trying to find some freedom for themselves, liberate themselves from these constraints, and that I think is a sign of some flux and some change that's happening. I think we should see great encouragement in that, and I think that the next step, when these events start to occur in a society, the next step is that a broader and broader mass of activists who won't put up with how these heroes are mistreated and hunted down and put into prison and so on, and who are willing to fight back, and where you get this growing level of discontent and pushing back that can happen like it did in the 60s and 70s around big issues like the Vietnam War and so on. You can have that happening in a society where the population feels extremely controlled and pressured, and as a result, there's psychological angst that gets... I mean, you can't live that way. You can't live in a way where you're being told about everything. You're being told when you can relax, when you can have holidays, when you can everything, and your behavior has to be entirely approved by the powers that be and your employer in every detail. And, you know, there are black box recorders in all the cars, so they know when you accelerate and when you turn a corner and everything, and the police can have that right away whenever they want. And there's all this surveillance everywhere, and it's just all that surveillance is being built in. You can't walk into a city without being on camera somewhere. So there are virtually no... It's a complete dystopia. There's no civil liberties for anyone. Everyone's being watched, and everybody's self-conscious about having a behavior that won't get them in trouble. And that's a high-pressure situation. We're in a pressure cooker, I think. And the human mind is not made for that kind of control. It creates incredible stress. It creates it's a major source of health problems. And there are detailed studies that show this, that the single biggest factor regarding your health is the degree to which you are pressed by society's power hierarchy, basically. And so there's some very serious top-level science that demonstrates this, that is far more important than what you eat and every other thing you can think of. You know, the only time that other factors are more important to your health is when you're in the middle of a war zone and you might be killed and so on. Then obviously that's the dominant factor regarding your health. But in non-civil war situations, it's all about oppression. You know, studies show that it directly affects your immune system, which in turn makes you susceptible to the big killers, which are heart disease and cancer. So there's an intimate link between immune metabolism and those big killers. Those are the major killers in our populations. And that immune system is most directly affected by the oppression that you actually are subjected to, but also the oppression that you feel. In other words, how you feel about your place in society, whether you feel oppressed or not, whether you feel that you're in a low stratum that everyone can step on you, then your health is going to suffer dramatically.
Danny, it's so true. And the big difference between today and many decades ago, I'm old enough to remember some of those older decades, was the advances in technology, where if you go back to the 40s and 50s and the congressional hearings and especially the McCarthy hearings that I remember so well, they televised them. They televised McCarthy hearings. I watched McCarthy on television grilling his subjects, and I watched the most historic hearing live when the lawyer for the Army private, I believe he was, forget his name, but an Army private, Joe Welch was the lawyer, when he confronted McCarthy and he said to him, have you no sense of mercy? I mean, this low-key lawyer destroyed Joe McCarthy in front of millions of viewers. I think this was in the afternoon after classes. I was in college, and after classes I turned on TV. I was still at home before I lived at school my last 2 years, and I saw some of the hearings. and I saw this one that was so historic, and I remember it, and in a couple of articles I went back and I quoted Joe Welch and what he said, and the fact that this was a turning point, and it literally, it wasn't too long after that, that McCarthy literally went down the drain. I mean, can you imagine that happening today? But McCarthy went down the drain.
No,
he was an alcoholic. He died young. He got censured by the Senate, almost an impossibility today. But if the technology we have today existed then, it would have been just as bad then as now. And I also remember the FBI's COINTELPRO program that went after Native Americans and Black Americans and activists, anti-war people. Anybody that challenged the system, they went after viciously, but they didn't have the technology that's around today.
Yeah, but when you were watching the McCarthy hearings, what year was that?
That was probably around 1953.
Yeah, yeah. Because this, you know, I see it as a big cycle in the sense that in society, typically institutions drive you towards more control. And institutions are the arm of the powerful, and they drive a society towards more control, always. All the major institutions, whether it's the legal and prison system, the military system, even the university system, all of them, the hospitals, the health system, everything, these big institutions develop in a way towards more control over the individual and more control for the powerful. And this, so that's the natural tendency. And so it increases pressure on the individual that intimately needs freedom and needs to not be oppressed to be well. And so McCarthyism, you could say, was like about the time of a peak where the institutions had developed in this way where you could have that kind of process. But then the individual started to needing to break free from that, and maybe the example you gave was an example of a person being accused that decided to defend themselves, you know, and then you have a few individuals who do that, and then there's a broader sentiment, and then you can push it back a little, which I think is what happened in the 60s. And then, of course, you get back into the gears turning, you know, the institutions will, there will be a resetting of the institutions. They'll rewrite, like for universities in the 60s, they rewrote the charters, they rewrote that students were adults and that they could participate in all the major committees like Senate and so on, Board of Governors and so on. And so students acquired a lot of newfound freedoms. Universities were all about academic freedom all of a sudden, and so on. And then the institution advances, and they eat away at what you just won, and they create policies for the behavior of students, and policies to respect other students, and all this kind of stuff. And they just put you back into this pressure cooker over the course of a decade or two or three decades, and before you know it, individuals are feeling it again, all this terrible pressure, and they maybe it'll drive people to find ways to cope. It'll have all these effects, but in the end, there. A few more individuals will want to break free, will do brave acts, and eventually, if the pressure keeps up and if they don't find the way, yet another policy change or yet another tax change or yet another something to control it, eventually there are these moments where people revolt and you get some changes. It doesn't have to be an all-out civil war. It could just be like the kind of revolution that happened in the 60s, you know. But you have to sort of follow this and see it. I mean, there's this constant battle between individual freedom and the oppression of the organized system of power, which uses institutions. So sometimes we activists think, well, we just need better policies and better rules. But the problem with that model of how to make things better is that they are the ones that control the rulemaking. They're the ones that actually write the law. So you might go out on the street and fight for a better law of this and that, but then when it actually gets written, it's the powerful behind closed doors who actually write the text of it. And then it's judges and that system that actually interpret it. So you end up with something that's always, not always, but often worse than it was. And instead, I think as activists, we need to look into ourselves, look at our own personal ability to fight back and to recover the dignity that comes with fighting back, and to say, well, I'm going to stand up for this. And I think that's what Bradley Manning is all about. I think that's what Snowden is all about. And I celebrate these individuals who had the guts to do that. But I think that my interpretation of their actions is that they could not have lived with themselves to keep these secrets. They were at a place in their lives and in their moral values where they had to do this in order to have a better life or chance of a better life. And so I think they were compelled to do it by the instinct that we all have to be free and to have influence in the world and to participate in making the world a better place. And most of us have that suppressed out of us by all of these pressures and this systemic, you know, oppression and so on. So that, you know, well, I'm actually giving you in a nutshell what my book is all about. We mentioned my book once before.
Oh, we sure did, and I'm very eager to hear more about it, Denny.
Yeah, it's called Hierarchy and Free Expression in the Fight Against Racism. But it's a very broad book that is a lot about society's power struggles and the individual and the interplay between the individual and the individual's needs and this whole system of control that surrounds us. But yeah, you know, maybe we have time. When we started today, I said there were two things that the university had done in my arbitration hearings. And then I never got to the second one, so some of your listeners might actually be hanging on and waiting, so I wanted to mention the other one. Should I do that?
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead. Right ahead.
So I mentioned that they had argued that I was inciting students to violence. The other big argument that they had to argue that I should not be allowed back on campus was that I was seeking vengeance by blogging about those that were involved in my dismissal. So they argued that my blog, U of O Watch, was something that I was using to attack, to unreasonably attack and to illegitimately attack by the criticisms and by the way the blog posts were written, anyone who was involved in my dismissal. Well, they got that wrong, because I was, in my blog, I criticized everybody, whether or not you were involved with my dismissal. If I see something on campus that I'm aware of, that I know about, or that I learn about, whether it involves a professor or a student group or the president of the university, I blog about it. And but this is what they were doing. So basically, their arguments were twofold. One, the first one about inciting students to violence, you could summarize that by saying they were trying to argue that I was corrupting the youth. And the second one, you know, blogging in a vengeful way against important people, if you like, well, that's you could say that's insulting important people. So basically, corrupting the youth and insulting important people were the charges against me. And when was the last time that happened? You know, it was a perfect Socratic trial, is what it was. I mean, this is what they were arguing. And I was trying to explain that criticism is important, it's essential, and this is why I do it. And that discussion with the youth and exchanging on very difficult topics and so on, and honestly giving your opinion and hearing other people's opinions, is what the university is all about. Those were my counter-arguments, but that's how it went down. It was incredible.
Denny, I feel that you're never insulting anybody when you tell the truth.
Well, you know, I think you're being respectful to the other person when you tell them what you really think and believe about them, and you use words that are strong to get the point across and to make them understand without ambiguity that you are being critical of them and that you believe that they, you know, it's your opinion that they've done something that merits that kind of criticism.
Oh, absolutely. It reminds me of Harry Truman back in 1948 on the campaign trail when they did whistle stops in those days rather than flying aircraft, and they would stop at a town or a community, whatever. And at one of them, a supporter called out to Truman, "Give him hell, Harry." And his comment back was, "Well, I tell them the truth and they think it's hell."
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's another thing that I don't like about modern discourse is that too many people, and I think the system drives you towards this, they drive us towards being concerned about form versus content. So they get very sensitive about your choice of words, more so than about the actual content of the criticism that you're making. You have to be politically correct. You have to be very careful. You can't use. For example, you know, if it's gotten to the point where if you say if you use the word deaf, like are you deaf? Meaning you don't understand? You know, or you didn't understand what I said? Well, the deaf community will be very upset with you because they feel that you're denigrating them, but at the same time, and I understand that, and I want to respect the deaf community, but at the same time, it's part of our language to use the word deaf in that way. And everybody understands, and it's powerful, it's got imagery. You know, if we start being language police to that extent, then we can't be ourselves. We're constantly second-guessing our every word, and we can't do anything. And so there are these allergic reactions to form, allergic reactions to strong language. And I think a lot of it is class-based. I mean, often the working class will not be so concerned about form, and you'll get a lot of language that the upper middle class would consider inappropriate, but it's the language that they use to express what they need to. And if you try to bring that language into the middle class, if you're like I do, often I bring those strong expressions and that strong language into my blogging or into my speech in order to shake things up and in order to create an interaction between the classes so that the middle class is challenged by the ideas and the criticisms of the classes that are lower in the oppression strata, if you like. And I do that consciously, and I do it in my blog, and I do it all the time. The same is true of sensitive topics like race and religion and so on, you know. You can use language in a way that's powerful. You have a responsibility to do it because you have a responsibility to have the influence that you honestly and authentically want to have in society. You do that, and you'll get attacked for form. And I think that my understanding of it is when people do that, when they go after you over form, what they're really saying is, we don't want you to make that criticism. We don't want you to make it in a powerful way that people understand. We don't want to hear that. We don't think it's legitimate that you can make that criticism. I think that's what they're saying when they attack form.
Absolutely. And yeah. your teaching method was really extraordinary. You got the best out of your students because of what you did, and they loved you, and they said so. They never had anyone else teach them the way you did, and for you to be attacked on something that worked so well was just another outrage against you, Denny.
Yeah, I mean, at the hearings in my arbitration, I explained how my physics course, the first-year physics course that I did for 20 years, how I'd brought it to the point where I really found methods that worked, where the students were very excited about physics instead of being afraid of it, where they came to class in great numbers. The attendance was almost 100%, which is unheard of in a first-year physics class. It's more typically in the 40 to 60%, you know, the attendance typically, I'm told by my colleagues. And they were doing research on their own. The class participation and discussions were amazing. And I explained in the hearings how I managed to achieve that and how proud I was of it.
Oh, it really was. We are plumb out of time. It always happens. You know, the clock is merciless. You know, the critics are merciless, and the clocks are absolutely merciless. We turn into pumpkins before the top of the hour, Denny. At least I do when they pull the plug on me. I look forward to getting you back for more. I wish we could continue it now, but I do very much look forward to getting you back for more and to discussing the related issues. Denny, thank you so much.
Well, it was fun as usual. Thank you, Stephen, for having
me. Thanks, Denny. Join us tomorrow, same time, 1 p.m. Eastern. Make it a regular habit. On Fridays, 11 a.m. Eastern, of course.